How dare he? Jess grips my wrist and brings her finger to her lips.
Listen.
There are footsteps which seem to move closer to us, presumably towards Caleb. This time I hear Daniel speak more clearly.
Personally, I've had doubts all along. For a start, he says, she's a slight woman. Our forensics team still seems to think that Mrs. Woods was strangled by a person bigger than herself.
Come on. Coupled with the DNA, I think we have enough evidence now, don't you?
It's Maya's voice, high and sharp over the vowels.
DNA?
I mouth at Jess.
I'll ask you one more time, says Daniel. You really believe she could have done this?
Yes.
Yes.
I think of our conversation that night on the sea wall overlooking Chowpatty Beach.
I'm sorry, Isabel, that so much of this is out of your control, Daniel had said. I didn't know what he meant, but now I think I do.
Have I really been a suspect all along? Did Daniel deceive me to get me to come here and do Valhalla's experiments, even though they were preparing to arrest me? I press my hand against the base of my neck and shake my head in disbelief at Jess. She looks quite composed, almost as if this is what she had expected to hear. She jerks her head towards the door.
Go!
We rise and run out of the room and back the way we've come, flitting around people until we're in the atrium again. I'm breathless and my heart thuds against the walls of my chest, overwhelming my jumbled thoughts. Jess takes my hand and pulls me into the lift.
Isabel, listen to me. You need to go back to your hotel now. Take out some cash, not too much, and go somewhere, anywhere.
What do you mean? They're going to arrest you, Iz. And once they've done that... A voice trails off as the doors close and the lift sinks.
But it's ridiculous. What would my motivation be to kill the wife of a dying man?
I don't know. Jess sighs and tips her head back, staring up at the ceiling of the lift.
I don't know. Plain old jealousy.
But I didn't do it. I didn't kill her.
I whisper. There is a man and woman in the lift with us, and they are looking right at us now.
How could they think?
Valhalla are powerful.
Caleb is powerful. And you heard them mention DNA evidence. If this is what they want...
Caleb just lied to a detective about me.
He wants Daniel to believe I killed Sarah.
I stumble over my words because I can't believe what is happening.
Why?
I don't know, but trust me, you've just got to get out of here. You've got to buy me some time to figure this all out. The lift doors open, and we move around the couple from the lift as they kiss each other. We walk across another glass atrium, through the automatic doors, and out into the glaring sunshine. I follow Jess blindly as I clench my fists and imagine pounding them into Caleb's face. We've never been close, but I can't think why he would betray me like this. There must be a reason. I can't trust anyone anymore, especially not anyone as ruthless as him.
I'm flying to London tonight to take Yarick's and Leela's mirror neurons back to the lab, Jess says.
She looks around and moves in the direction of the taxi rank.
I'll play it cool. I'll tell them that you wanted a few days away on your own. Go to the station and get a bus or a train out of here.
She pushes me into the back of a cab and leans over me to let the sensor scan her chip. She unbuttons her top pocket and cash flutters into my lap. I open my mouth to speak, but nothing comes out.
Please, Isabel, just do it, she says and slams the door shut.
She's back inside the building before we've even pulled away.
Chapter 25.
If only Leela could have come with me, I think.
Where are you going? She would have asked, eyes wide. Haven't you told them?
If she was still here, she'd stand up for me. She'd stop them doing anything. I make a mental note to write to her husband. While her absence has left me bereft, I have gained the ability to lie to whomever I wish. When the receptionist asks me where I am heading next, I don't hesitate for a moment.
Delhi, I tell her. I'm going to Delhi. They can find me there if they want.
I leave against an overcast sky, catching a taxi to Chhatrapati Shivaji Terminus to seek out the first bus I can find that isn't heading north towards Delhi. I take a wad of cash out of the ATM at the station, and then I run from bus to bus through the drizzle, not daring to pause to look over my shoulder. If anyone has followed me, they will catch me. I don't need to waste time worrying too much about it. I soon realize that the more modern driverless vehicles are locked to those without a ticket. I switch to targeting the most decrepit buses, begging for a seat from whomever is behind the wheel. Wet to the bone, I hammer on the door of a half-empty one as it is pulling away from its stand, placing my hands together in prayer to plead with the driver. It is only when I've paid that I ask him where we are going. He laughs at me, a deep, guttural laugh as if to say, "Crazy foreigner." "You are lucky today," he says. "You are going to the beach." I sleep for a few hours and wake up almost dry. Outside, the world is dark, and it feels as though we are weaving down a mountainside. We have left Mumbai far behind. I lean into the cracked window and focus on the contours of the road ahead, illuminated by the headlights so that I don't get sick. The air conditioning seems to have stopped working, and I'm squeezed next to a butterball of a man who crushes me with every nauseating turn of the bus. He chews betel leaf incessantly. Every so often he spits it out into a small sandwich bag that he ties back up and pushes into the depths of his pocket. For hours upon hours, I wait for the red, saliva-thickened juice to escape from it and soak through his thin trousers onto my thigh. And while I wait, I breathe deeply, trying to calm myself. And I think about Daniel, Caleb, and Maya's conversation. I try to be logical. I know I didn't kill Sarah. Therefore, Caleb and Maya should have no reason to believe that I did it. Nor should they really care, but they do. They care a lot, because it sounded as though they were trying to frame me. I take several more breaths, pushing my nails into my palms. The last thing Maya cared so much about was bringing me here to India to take advantage of my unique position to trial Valhalla's new technologies. I hear her voice again, forceful, insistent.
"I think we have enough evidence now, don't you?"
I bite my lip, mentally backtracking. What puts people on the attack? Fear. Always fear. The idea of ghost memories must terrify both Oakley and Valhalla. If proof of them was found, and it got out into the public domain, their empires would be shattered. No one would want a heaven. They'd be sued, destroyed. Daniel's team are on the trail, and I've been tantalizingly close to spotting them for myself, so would sending me down for murder stop me talking? Would it nullify my opinion if rumours ever surfaced? Would it throw Daniel and his team off the scent? And, most disturbingly, if they could stoop so low as to falsely accuse me, would they have had any qualms about committing the murder themselves? By the time I clamber down the steps into Anjuna's dust, I am dehydrated and physically drained, and I wish I had taken a train instead. The bus drops me in a car park that couldn't possibly be any closer to the cliff edge. Electric charging points line its perimeter. Motorbikes and rickshaws jostle for room, watched over by donkeys and goats. I stop for a few moments to gather my thoughts. I unwrap the cotton scarf from my head and flatten and fold it again, lying it back over the bare patches of scalp with the metal rings lodged in their center. I find myself gazing down over the rust-red rocks to the ocean below. Even in the warmth of the mid-morning sun, its confident light catching the crests of the waves, I feel a magnetic darkness drag me down. I look at a few rooms around Anjuna before I find myself on the far edge of the village, wandering through an unmarked back gate into the sandy gardens of the Ocean Pearl Guest House. I choose a small, private bungalow with a veranda out front, paying for 3 nights in advance. The smiling owner hands me a fresh coconut as a welcome gift, and I gratefully accept. His skin is marbled by vitiligo, but I try not to stare, and he tries not to stare back at me in return. The heat of the midday sun presses down on me, and I walk straight from the sand into the cool of my room. Lying down on the bed, I fall asleep until early evening, when I'm woken by a call from Daniel. I let the codex ring out, knowing that he could use it to pinpoint my location. Now, I'm sitting on the wicker chair by the front door of my bungalow. The noises screeching from beneath me suggest that it's not supposed to be a rocking chair. Yet, as I push my toes away from the warm tiles of the deck, it rocks nonetheless. Clouds of evening insects and mosquitoes storm about me. The last time I was in India, I remember obsessively taking my anti-malarial at the same time each morning, and our mother coating our bare skin with a pungent liquid every evening. How different it was then. Thankfully, the days of malaria are long gone. Another deadly disease wiped from the face of the planet. We're ticking them off, one by one. I close my eyes and imagine Jess sitting on the plane, a lab case containing the living remains of Leela and Yarrick upon her lap. Perhaps it doesn't stay in the cabin with her. Maybe it goes in some special secure hold, I don't know. I find it harder than ever to believe that people are dead longer than they are alive. When I really consider how fleeting life is, it's little wonder that I fell for Yarrick so quickly, so completely. It becomes less surprising that just a handful of shared connections, an abusive, absent father, the loss of a loved mother and a sister, a crisis of self-doubt and a willingness to cure it, would be enough to ignite a love affair in the face of death. Locusts chatter in the dune grasses, and the sky is painting itself in hues of pink and orange as the sun sinks behind the tall palm trees that camouflage my view of the ocean. This part of Goa is like a time capsule. It feels as if this place has been here for decades unchanged. I could be a hippie here, I think. I could go off-grid and hide away from the world, selling necklaces on the seashore, subsisting on stolen bananas, cheap taka dal and puri. But even that idea seems too fraught with difficulty. I turn my thoughts away and slip my fingertips beneath my headscarf, running them over the circles of stubble surrounding the metal plugs. I rub at the edge of one where I find a rough patch, and I rub and rub until I feel a strange sensation in my fingertip. It's only when I pull my hand away and bring the tip of my finger close to my face that I realize it's bleeding. I run through a tick list of symptoms in my head. Anxiety, hopelessness, fatigue. But this isn't really a depression, I think. It's an absence. An absence of any emotion whatsoever. I find it hard now, as I sit here, to even think about myself. I can watch the tiny bats swoop and flit. I can find a certain contentment in the sound of the sea washing the distant shoreline. But me, I'm done with myself. I am a vessel that has been emptied, and I have nothing with which to fill it again. All I can do is save Yarrick. Maybe I can figure out who killed Sarah and why. Maybe I can make them pay for what they've done to me, Yarrick and Leela. Slowly, I begin to drift off to sleep on the chair, with my feet dangling over the tiles. A gentle vibration in my ear canal wakes me up, alerting me to an incoming call. I blink into the pitch black, disoriented. And then the smell of sweat and seawater reminds me where I am. As I sit up, I see that the moon has sunk behind the palm trees. I glance at the time in my vision, 1:30. I unfurl my codex from the wicker side table and see that it's dawn. I think twice before answering. Hello? I say cautiously. I don't activate the visual link and lie back again, closing my eyes. He wouldn't be able to see me anyway.
Isabel, where are you?
His tone is piercing, probing. It makes me realize that I shouldn't be answering any calls. I can't let anyone find me. Hi, Don. And how are you?
This isn't the time for your sarcasm. I'm worried about you.
I don't reply. It's much cooler out here now. I ought to go inside, but I have to concentrate on this first.
Caleb messaged me a couple of hours ago saying you'd gone missing, saying he needed to find you.
Well, he doesn't need to find me.
He said it made things look worse for you, disappearing like this.
I had wondered that myself, but Jess had seemed so sure. I'm not capable of making my own decisions at the moment. Leela died, I say quietly. In the drone strike.
I know. I'm so sorry, Isabel.
His voice has mellowed back to the one I remember, deep and rich. And for a moment, I wish he was here in person. I know that he would hold me tight and make me feel better without saying a word. He knows me. He's one of the few people left who do.
What's going on?
Don asks, his voice swinging back at me in a tone so firm that it demands an answer. Yarrick, my client, his wife was murdered, strangled in her own home. I think I'm a suspect. Talk about cutting a long story short. There is silence on the line, but not from shock.
Don is never shocked.
Instead, he is thinking, and the emotionless void in my chest is overwhelmed with relief that he has got in touch. There is a reason he called. He will know what to do. He will help me.
When did it happen? The murder?
He asks. I run through my conversations with Daniel again in my head, summoning the details in full before I answer. And then I realize how easy it is to remember the date, because it was the same day I last saw Yarrick. It was a Friday evening, back in mid-September. The same night that we called things off.
The night you called things off,
he says, and I recoil at the hurt strung through his words. There's nothing I can say, so I wait again for his thoughts to process.
I got back to the flat at...
Late, I interrupt. It was late.
No, Assurance infuses his words, demanding my silence.
No, it wasn't that late. I think your mind's playing tricks. I got home at, what, 5, 6 p.m.
Of course. He's giving me an alibi. And he's doing it in such a gracious way that not only do I not have to acknowledge it or even thank him, but it is credible if the call is ever logged and listened to. He is making it plausible.
A Ministry of Defense consultant is always going to be believable. I almost believe him now.
I press my fingers into my cheeks. I could cry that he is doing this for me, but I can't help but wonder why he would be so nice to me. After everything that happened, he would be within his rights to... And my chest tightens. What if he had found out about Yarrick and I? Isn't it probable that a man who specializes in gathering intelligence would have known? Wouldn't that have driven him crazy with jealousy to know that I had made love to another man in our flat, and just hours later, Sarah was dead?
I let my hands slip across my mouth and blow my naivety out through the gaps in my fingers. What if this call isn't about providing me with an alibi, but about giving himself one too?
Yes, yes, you're right, I say, trying not to let my voice waver. It was around 5.
I hope you're okay, Iz.
His tone is softer again, his outside work mode. I hope you're okay. I know what he's going to say next, and I wish he wouldn't say it.
I love you, you know that.
Yes. Yes, I know. Part of me wishes I could love him. Everything else forgotten. Part of me wishes that I could fly home and walk back into our old flat to find him polishing his shoes at the kitchen table. This could be such an easy exchange. An alibi in return for affection. But all that is dead and buried. And the part of me that is left trusts no one. And I wonder whether the damage to my mirror neurons has done something to me. Whether it's wiped out my ability to love. Because all I feel is an emptiness that grates behind my ribs and hums in my ears. As I move inside the disheveled bungalow to its straw-filled bed and tuck the thin sheets around me, it's the only lullaby I have.
Chapter 26.
I spend hours wandering up and down the beach and staring out at the ocean. I almost feel normal, in a way. If I don't dwell on Leela and Yarrick, and the people who have betrayed me, if I forget the fear for a moment and try not to look for signs of recognition in the eyes of every person I pass...
To distract myself, I look repeatedly for the love inside my brain, and while I find the grief that results from love, and the memory of love, the love itself no longer feels like a tangible thing. I feel broken.
I walk along the beach most days, all the way to the headland and back. I'm careful, I suppose, in my own way. I don't stop for a drink or meal in the same place twice. I don't make conversation. I ignore the repeated calls from Daniel and unknown contacts. I don't do anything to draw attention to myself. Luckily, there are lots of cafes and bars dotted along the edge of the sands. I got drunk on one of my first days here, on a fast succession of distractingly fruity, free-poured cocktails. I'm not doing that again. It sent me into a morose downward spiral that only sleep could clear. Often, I buy a coconut from the beach vendors and sit right at the edge of the waves, sipping on the clean freshness of the milk, before catching the vendor on their return and asking them to split it open with their machete so that I can scrape at the flesh inside. I watch them attack the coconut with a practiced strike and again find myself wondering, if I didn't do it, and Yarick didn't do it, then who did? Who killed Sarah? Her lover? Could it even have been Don seeking revenge of some kind? Could Maya and Caleb want me silenced after everything I've seen? Could one of them have arranged the murder in the first place to make me desperate to prove Yarick's innocence, to get me here, taking part in their experiments? One afternoon, I let a girl on the beach decorate my feet with henna. She paints the prettiest, most intricate patterns, down to tiny swirls around my toenails and many-petaled flowers between each knuckle. She adorns me with toe rings and anklets in an effort to get me to spend more money. She clips earrings onto my lobes and holds up a hand mirror so that I can admire myself.
"Pretty," she says.
I look back at the woman in the mirror and wonder when it was that I last properly looked at myself. I don't see pretty. I never did. But I do see gaunt shadows on the face I was once so well acquainted with. I look tired and dehydrated. But that isn't it. My eyes are disheveled. Stray hairs have roughened the once perfect arches of my brows. My skin is less clean, less cared for. I've never seen my hair wrapped in a headscarf like this, let alone one that's been reused for days in a row and has become an excuse for not washing my hair. The girl takes away the mirror to slip it back into her bag, and I look down at myself. I would never have let a stranger decorate my body with cheap metal a few weeks ago. I would never have worn anything that wasn't tailored and grey, black, or white. And now I'm dressed in an orange crocheted tunic and baggy cream elasticated trousers that I once would have thought a dirty colour. I am changed, there is no doubt. Yet the change has not brought peace. I am more alone than ever, and the arguments that rage inside my head are louder.
"What is this?"
the girl asks, in impeccable English, pointing at my tattoo. She looks at me with shy eyes beneath thick lashes. "It's an angel." I smile at the confusion in her face. It's as if she hasn't heard of one before. "They have wings," I say, tracing the outline. "They live in heaven and carry out God's wishes."
"Really?"
Her brown eyes widen. I feel bad.
No, they're just make-believe.
She smiles, relieved.
"Hopefully I'll make enough money this week,"
she says, settling down beside me and mimicking my position by resting her elbows on her knees.
"And then I'll be able to take my brother to school with me next month."
I look at her with veiled cynicism. She wants me to buy this anklet, the most expensive one, that she insists is made from silver and inlaid with lapis lazuli. I can see that it's nickel and glass, but I can't bring myself to tell her this. "Do you like school?" I ask. She nods vigorously. English is her favorite, she tells me. She likes her teacher, and one day she wants to travel the world. We sit together for a while in a friendly silence, and then she asks me again if I'd like the anklet. I tell her to ask me again tomorrow, which she seems satisfied with, and she skips away down the beach, a boxed-up shop jangling against her childish hips. The next morning, I wake early and find a spool of cotton in the bedside drawer. I settle in the shard of sunlight that cuts through the small window and thread out the stray hairs on my shins. I'd like to do my eyebrows, but the only mirror is fixed to the wall in the dark bathroom. I stretch out my legs and note how I look more like my mother every day. I eat pineapple on the porch and file my nails with a beaded glass file I bought on the beach a couple of days ago. When Jess calls, I find that I have the strength to wipe the juice from my chin and talk to her. "Hello," I say, while I'm still unfurling my codex. "How are you?" "I'm fine." Then, "You sound brighter." Maybe I do. I'm not sure. The hologram viewer kicks in, and I see Jess leaning forward on her elbows.
"I wanted to try and catch you before I go to bed," she says. "Are you safe?"
"No, probably not." Jess ignores my sarcasm.
"Seriously, can your codex be tracked?"
"I got a guy to disable that shortly after I upgraded last year," I explain, pursing my lips. "But I did wonder whether there's still a way the police could track it, if they really wanted to. I don't know."
"Okay, we'll keep this brief. You look well, though. No after effects from the operations?"
I think of the spongy darkness pressing in on me and filling the gaps between my thoughts. "Nothing I can think of," I say.
"So, Daniel has had you down as a suspect all along," she says.
I'm still surprised, I suppose. I thought he liked me. It always seemed like he was making allowances for me.
He is the one who talked me into going on this ridiculous errand.
Fresh anger bristles across my skin.
"And now Caleb and Maya have turned against you too. Together, they're even more powerful. Oakley Associates and Valhalla are one and the same now. They're signing the paperwork today. The rumors are that Valhalla got Oakley for a bargain in the end."
"Oh." I fall quiet, looking past the image of Jess to the sparkling sea beyond. It's a distant world, that meeting about the single opt-in, being told off by Leela, fighting with Maya and Caleb. "I have an alibi, though."
"That's fantastic! Who?"
"Don. He called me a few days ago."
"Great! That's great!"
She sounds unconvinced, but it's good to have her company. Seeing her makes me realize how lonely I've been. She squints at me.
"You do know how she was killed, right?"
I nod in response. I don't feel inclined to drag myself back through the details, especially if Jess already knows them.
"So you know that she was strangled and then drugged, just for good measure, perhaps to ensure death before a quick getaway."
She pauses, nibbling at her lip.
"What were your thoughts on the high-strength opioids?"
Jess levels her gaze at me again, and her jaw tightens. It takes me a few seconds to process what she is saying.
"Opioids?"
I feel a knot of nerves unfurl itself from its hiding place, deep behind my ribs.
"Daniel didn't tell you that detail, huh?"
I shake my head, my eyes fixed on her face.
"Where would the murderer have got his hands on pills like that, Isabel?"
Jess asks. Her voice wavers. I don't need to offer her a response. Receptive as ever, she is already convinced of where those pills came from.
"An alibi is good," Jess continues, "but it's not enough. This and the DNA evidence we heard them mention, I don't know any more about that, but it looks bad for you, Isabel."
"I know. I know it does." I can hardly hear my own voice, and I have to look away from the display. I haven't been forced to admit it to myself before, and the breath falls out of me like I've been punched in the solar plexus.
So, we need to uncover evidence that he did it, given that nobody else seems to be bothering.
You think it was a man? Jess sighs heavily. Come on, Izzy. I think we both know it must have been Yarrick. I stare back at her resolute.
What did he tell you? She asks. Did he say he hated her? Had she done something to hurt him? I need something to look for.
My eyes zigzag across the hologram of her face, searching for a part of it that I can believe in.
Who else would have done it, Iz? Who else?
Her accent deepens and her voice rises like hot air swirling around me. I feel dizzy. Not him.
So who did?
She's swallowing back her anger now, but her derision is clear and sudden, like the day when she warned me about my relationship with Yarrick. The memory of her words resonates in my temples. We don't leave everything behind us when we die anymore. We take others with us.
You think a stranger found their way into her house and then murdered her with a packet of pills that they happened to find in the bathroom cabinet? Pills that were once yours, she continues.
Maybe someone else knew about them, I mumble. Daniel told me that Sarah had been seeing someone. He might have been to the house before. He might have seen them.
Really? That's interesting. I just wonder what the motivation would have been. The details of the murder make it seem pre-planned, not a hot-headed mistake. And wouldn't they have found some of his DNA at the scene?
We don't know that they didn't. And what about Caleb? He has access to the same drugs dispensary as me. He could have got the same pills.
Does that really seem even vaguely likely to you?
If we're talking about what's likely, what would Yarrick's motivation have been, Jess? He was already dying himself. Why on earth would he kill his wife? Jess shrugs. Any number of reasons.
I think we need to consider Caleb and Valhalla. Maya wanted me here, doing this, helping them. And Sarah's murder achieved that. If it's a motivation we're looking for...
I can hear my voice rising with desperation.
Well, I don't know much about Valhalla, but Caleb is nasty. Isabel, you know that.
She pauses and sighs.
On a personal level, I'd say he's furious that you walked out on him. And from a business point of view, you're dangerous to them now. Confidentiality agreement or no confidentiality agreement.
See, I thought this too, I agree. If you or I went on the public record talking about ghost memories... Jess nods, looking away from the camera for a few moments.
They'd be finished.
I realize that she too is treading on dangerous ground.
Although Daniel's team knows about the possibility of ghost memories too. If they were found, they'd want to use them in criminal trials. It would all come out then, wouldn't it?
Maybe, I say. It's hard to know I'm thinking straight when I feel so paranoid.
That could be why they're keeping him so close. They want to control what he knows, what he does with the information he gets access to.
We're getting off track, Jess sounds exasperated.
I can't do anything to examine anyone else's motives, Isabel. I can only look at Yarrick's.
I look past her again, back to the shoreline and the steadily rising sun. You really loved him, didn't you? Jess speaks calmly again, recovering herself. I nod because it's all I can do. Anything else will wipe me out. I realize that not once has Jess asked me outright if I did it. She trusts me, and I take a huge amount of comfort in that. But how could she possibly think that Yarrick
did it. She met him so many times. She scanned his brain. She created the simulations of his heaven. She would have seen his easy smile, listened to his jokes, admired his lack of self-pity, his calm strength, and talked to him about his love for his daughters.
"I'd better go," I say.
"Just quickly. I know you'll be disappointed, but I thought you might want to know that Single Optim was approved by the Council on Bioethics last week. With their endorsement, I think it'll slip through Parliament quickly."
I watch Jess shake her head. She feels the same way about it as I do. Things are going to change. I hang up and feel the sigh reverberate through my body. I let the tension spread and settle while the self-recriminations rise to the surface. I walked away from the clinic when I should have stayed to fight against the rollout of Single Optin. I could have made a difference, but I gave up when it really mattered. I get up and walk down to the beach through the dappled light cast by the palm trees. Jess is right. Things will change now. People will be able to put whomever they want in their heavens without that person's permission. I imagine that most of my old clients, now long gone, would have been excited by the thought of including a Hollywood actor or a teenage crush. Almost innocent. But the slippery ethics of it are unavoidable. Single Optin derails the sanctity of heaven, and other laws will swiftly follow, no doubt. Valhalla and the law enforcement agencies will get their wish of being able to root through the mental realms of strangers. What they've just made me do will be outdated. It's likely that soon anyone will be able to rifle through Yarrick's heaven. I push his name away as I hear it emerge inside my head. I cannot engage with it now. I reach the ocean and stand on the shoreline, letting the shallow waves lap at my feet. The water is still cold with night, and I squint down at the tiny white shells rolling helplessly over my toes. Things could have been so different. If Single Optin had been approved earlier and the other rules relaxed, we may not have had to come all the way to India to get into Yarrick's heaven. What we did would have been far less of a grey area than what Daniel described that day on the Maiden. A room full of people prying into Yarrick's heaven from the safety of London would have been little more than a technicality. They might not have needed me at all. Leela would be alive. I stand there, contemplating an early morning swim in my clothes, until the sand reaches my mid-shin. Then I turn and wander back towards my bungalow. If I can, I think I might go back to sleep for a while. The little girl is waiting for me near the gate to the guest house. Today she is dressed in a bright purple cotton dress with frills at the hem and neck, but I recognize the lopsided smile and her narrow shoulders. As I get closer, I see that the anklet is dangling from her index finger and a cheeky giggle erupts from her.
"Oh, hello," I say. "Who are you?"
She giggles again, her whole face bursting with delight at my joke. I ruffle my hand through the hair on the top of her head.
"Hello, lady. Do you still like this?"
"Yes, I do." Without hesitating, she kneels in the sand and fastens it around my ankle before I can change my mind. I wait for her to get up again, but she's staring at the angel.
"Why did you have a picture of something that isn't real?" she asks.
She looks up at me, and her cheeks are pulled in, making the bones stand out beneath her eyes. There's a seriousness to her face, as if she somehow knows what it means to me.
I chose something that's not real because I didn't know what to believe anymore. She nods as if this makes perfect sense and stands up, casually slipping her tiny, dry hand into mine.
Do you know what to believe now?
I lose myself in the open innocence of her face. I feel a thrust of something in my chest that swirls upwards, a warmth which rises to the very top of my head. And then I realize what I'm feeling isn't the loss of my capacity to love. It's an explosion of my capacity to doubt.
Chapter 27. I'm in the village, sitting in a restaurant that commands an addictive view over Anjuna's rocky cliffs and the ocean below. As I eat, I watch the local fishermen haul in their catch onto the beach far below me. I can't make out their faces, but their bare backs are slick with effort, and I feel guilty for sitting here under the shaded tarpaulin. Jess's latest message blinks on the screen of my codex. "Are you there, Izzy?" I wave at the screen and the word "hello" automatically appears. I'm running low on rupees, and this restaurant's cheap, so I've been here a few days in a row. The charming elderly owner seems to be feeding me up, despite my poverty, tempting me with aromatic fish curries and elaborate ice cream sundaes sprinkled with dried flakes of banana and coconut. When I arrived an hour or so ago, he poked me in the ribs, nodding with satisfaction that his concoctions are filling out the gaps between my bones. On the beach, children are playing at the edge of the nets, trying to grab fish caught in the outer reaches. The fishermen swat them away like flies. When I glance back at my codex, another message is waiting for me. "On my way into meeting. We'll call properly later. Need to tell you something." I reply immediately, "What?" I lean closer to the screen. I don't blink. But she doesn't reply within a few seconds, so I turn my attention back to finishing up my masala dosa while I wonder what news she could have. I've got better at eating without cutlery. It's meditative, the action of tearing the pancake between the fingers of my right hand, and then sweeping it around the plate again and again until it's clean. "Found something in Yarrick's heaven. Hang in there. It's going to be okay." My mouth falls open.
"It's a great view," says a man's voice over my shoulder. A voice I recognize. A voice I'd been listening for in every shop, on every turn of the path for the past week. I yank my codex into my chest and shut my eyes. The reality is that I nearly choke on the last piece of dosa, but I purse my lips and swallow repeatedly until I found some composure and raised my defenses. Daniel pulls out a chair right beside me and sits down without even looking at my face to double-check that it's me. I look around, narrowing my eyes at the owner, who is standing awkwardly near the kitchen door. He must have fallen under Daniel's charm as well as mine. I notice that there are two Indian policemen standing by the entrance, notable by their drab khaki uniform. They see me look over at them, but they remain expressionless. With podgy arms folded over their guts, they look like glorified bouncers.
"I can see why you came here," Daniel adds.
"I got on the first bus that would take me. This isn't a holiday." I refuse to be the one to try to make eye contact first. I watch the fishermen and silently note that their day is suddenly looking a lot better than mine.
"Why did you think you had to run away?"
he asks, resting his cheek onto his fist so that he's looking at me. He appears to find me amusing.
I don't know. Why do you think that I killed Sarah?
At that moment, the owner appears beside me to clear my plate. I shoot him an accusatory glare, and I don't know if it's that, or the nature of our conversation, that makes him scuttle away with empty hands.
There are people that think you did, yes.
He spreads his hands onto the table now, and it is deliberate body language, of course. He's telling me that all his cards are on the table and that I can trust him. I feel nothing of the sort. Not you? You haven't thought it, right from the beginning? His head wobbles in a response that gives little away. His time in India is starting to reflect in him. Jess and I heard you talking in Maya's office, the three of you.
You weren't supposed to.
No shit, he sighs.
It hasn't helped your case to try and disappear like this.
I have an alibi, I tell him.
You do? That's good.
His eyes seem to match the genuineness of his voice. The fishermen are gathering up the nets now. It's like a dance as they move in their practiced routine, skipping around the edges and meeting in the middle to bring them first into a snake-like tube and then into a coil. More locals gather on the sidelines. The children continue to dart over the nets, and the adults wave their hands around, haggling for lunch. I think of the message from Jess and wonder desperately what it could mean.
Interesting conversation.
Daniel gestures at the codex, nestled against my stomach. It's the supercilious tone which gets me. I furl the screen into a scroll and present it to him. As his hand opens to take it, I fling it across the table and out over the cliff edge. Daniel bites his cheek and shakes his head, fighting back a smile.
Have you finished? He asks, gesturing to my gleaming plate, a warm grin upon his face.
Not quite.
Come on, Isabel. We really do have to go now.
I think about making another joke, but one glance at his face stops me. The smile is gone. He won't meet my eyes. There are two of him, and it's evident that he's torn between them. Or perhaps he knows that he can't make me play his game. Are you arresting me? I push my plate away and lean back in my chair as I twist slightly to face him. He looks beyond me.
I'd rather not.
Do you have an international warrant? Filled out all the forms on the journey down here, did you? I'm guessing. I bet he hasn't. I bet he's relying on me being compliant. His eyes flash at me, and I know I'm right.
I could ask these men to arrest you. He gestures to the officers who are still standing waiting beside the entrance. They're not too worried about paperwork, given the right incentives.
Oh, yeah, I snort. You? Mr. Strait? Daniel stands up at that and leans over me, resting his hands on the arms of my flimsy plastic chair. I feel it start to buckle with his weight. His shadow covers me completely.
I'm telling you, this isn't the time for games. You come back to London with me now, or you stay here in a cell until I have filled in the forms and got the warrants that you think are so important.
I stay seated, looking up at him. I almost want to laugh, it's so ridiculous.
I don't want to force you, Isabel.
He speaks too softly for anyone around us to hear. He reaches for my forearm, and I resist for a second, which lasts longer than thinking through my available options. I must believe that Jess will come through for me. I let him ease me up out of the chair. Once upon a time, I would have kicked him in the shins and run, and I very nearly tell him so. He leads me out of the restaurant, weaving between the tables. I let my spare hand trail over the backs of chairs as we go. The owner watches us,
standing still, arms by his side, next to the serving station. He nods at me, half smiles.
Thanks for the sundaes,
I say. The Indian officers nod politely and let us walk past them before following, their heads bowed. We walk out of the palm leaf festooned doorway, and Daniel turns to go up the hill. I have things in my room, I say to him. He pauses, possibly to look at the time.
We don't have long, but okay.
I hear him say something to the policeman, and they head up the hill. Daniel and I start walking in the opposite direction, and I lead him this time, through the stalls that close in around us and the patter of the cellars. The smell of cinnamon wafts at us from a gloomy passageway. I glance down it into the jumbled network of cobbled paths. We duck beneath the silky ceilings of the sari shop, and I feel that I'm almost free of him. I slip ahead, pushing the fringed tassels of sarongs and shawls apart. I could run, but I don't.
Is it much further? Daniel asks.
No, I call over my shoulder. Just around the bend. We break free of the stalls, and the path opens out into the heat of the day. Sand mixes with the dust inside my sandals. We turn left onto the road, and then veer around the corner to the ocean view. Daniel places his hand on the peeling paint of the gatepost.
I'll wait here.
I walk through the sandy gardens dotted with patches of grass. I try to commit it all to memory. The scent of the sea, the ladies selling fruit from the tops of their heads, and the tall, dense copse of palm trees that partially obscures the view down to the sea. I let myself into my room and look around. I already have my bag, and into it I add my main toiletries from around the sink. I push in a few items of clothing, but most of it was cheap. England will be too cold now for this thin cotton. It's already late October. I count. Yarrick has been gone for 6 weeks. I get down on my knees and look under the bed. I pull the pillows off the mattress. I need to hurry, I know, but I can't find what I'm really looking for. The window ledge is bare, as is the wooden side table. I sweep my hands over the inlaid mother-of-pearl flowers. I check the bathroom again. As I'm about to leave, my heart heavy, I see that what I'm looking for is hooked over the door handle. I clip the already dulling metal around my ankle. I smile as I walk out and close the door behind me. For a few moments, I stand on the porch, squinting in the direction of the beach. I'm looking for the diminutive figure and listening for the tinny rattle of jewellery. I hate not saying goodbye. There are too many people I haven't been able to say goodbye to recently. I wait for a few moments, unrewarded. My throat tightens, and I feel the tickle of tears on my eyes. I fold my mouth into a sad smile and blow a kiss out at nothing, out at the shifting sand and the rolling ocean beyond it. I turn away and walk back to meet Daniel. The owner waves at me energetically from his own porch as I get close to the gate. I need to settle up, I call to Daniel.
Already done,
he says, shaking his head and wiping the flakes of old paint from his hands. The car journey to Goa International Airport takes about an hour. Daniel sits in the front with one of the local policemen, while I remain silent in the back next to the other one. I stare out at India and wonder if I will miss it. I think I will. Daniel takes sporadic calls and hums along to the radio. I note that he sings along to the same songs I would if I wasn't too busy being furious. I see Jess's message flashing across my vision. Found something in Yarrick's heaven. She was looking for ghost memories. So what has she found?
It's going to be okay.
Okay for me, for Yarick, for both of us. The car got